Tune in to Copenhagen Daily every day from 11 a.m. till noon throughout the UN Climate Conference on Resonance 104.4 FM and online at resonancefm.com. Welcome to Copenhagen Daily, reporting from the Bella Center in Copenhagen on what is undoubtedly the most important meeting in human history. Thanks for bearing with us while we find our feet. Copenhagen Daily is a networked experiment amongst a number of people both here in Copenhagen and in London. In today's show, we have an interview with Cassie Siegel from the Center for Biological Diversity on why President Obama doesn't need to wait for Congress to bring science-based targets to the table when it comes to Copenhagen at the end of next week. We have an interview with Tim Jackson on why Copenhagen needs to restructure our economy if it is to be truly successful in combating climate change. Frederica Whitehead takes a trip to the Parallel People Summit that's happening here in Copenhagen and picks up some testimony. And we give the Carbon Town Crier's heart-melting Copenhagen song, The Overflowing, its first airing. But first, on the day that President Obama picked up his Nobel Peace Prize, which was awarded partly due to his re-engagement on climate change internationally, the massive civil society organisation, the Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance, sent a letter to President Obama, pleading with him to fulfil the promise of his inauguration speech and to not betray his brothers and sisters in Africa. PACTCHA delegate Sylvia Wachira was kind enough to read it for us.
My name is Sylvia Wachira from the Pan-Africa Climate Justice Alliance. Dear Mr. President, we write to you with great pride and respect your leadership. You are known throughout our continent as the son of Africa. We are your brothers and sisters from Africa. We represent an alliance of civil society organizations in 43 countries across Africa that brings together a diverse group of people who share a common concern for our continent and the growing catastrophe of climate change. In your inaugural address to the presidency of the world's most powerful nation, you affirmed your commitment to help the world's poor by saying, I quote, "To the people of poor nations, we pledge to work alongside you to make your farms flourish and let clean waters flow, to nourish starved bodies and feed hungry minds, and to those nations like ours that enjoy relative plenty, we say we can no longer afford indifference to the suffering outside our borders, nor can we consume the world's resources without regard to effect." End of quote. We take these pledges seriously, and we intend to hold you to your word. Our rivers are drying, our crops are turning to dust, and unrelenting sun scorches our land, while other areas are ravaged by storms and diseases. Scientists now say the world could warm by 6 degrees Celsius, and by more in Africa. This threatens nothing less than the collapse of our continent. Today, Africa grapples with a challenge that is not of our making. Impacts we had little role in causing. We find no alternative but to look to those nations that contribute most to causing climate change and to call on them to lead by example. As the world's largest contributor to greenhouse gas concentrations and as the world's wealthiest nation, the United States has a singular duty to ensure that Africa is kept safe from rising impacts of climate change. Yet, we find it failing in this duty, along with other leaders of developed nations you have proposed. One, that global average temperatures be limited to below 2 degrees Celsius. Yet, this threatens catastrophic harm to Africa, which will likely warm by around 1.5 times this global average. The global emissions be limited to 50% of 1990 levels by 2050. Yet this risks a 50% chance of exceeding 2 degrees Celsius. And third, that Annex 1 countries cut their emissions by 80% by 2050, which would rob Africa of its fair share of atmospheric space and limit our prospects of development while we grapple with a more hostile climate. You are coming to Europe to receive a Nobel Prize in Oslo and to attend the UN Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen. You must live up to the dignity of the Nobel Prize when you come to Copenhagen. You must listen to the voice of other countries, including Africa. Our greatest single concern is that the United States seems to be seeking to continue domestic pollution well into the future by offsetting its emission in Africa, further transferring the burden of curbing climate change to those people who had little role in causing it. Furthermore, we are concerned that the United States, by insisting on remaining outside the Kyoto Protocol, has become a pretext for other developed countries to seek to evade rather than implement their legal binding obligations under the Kyoto Protocol. This undermines the only international agreement that establishes binding international emissions targets for developed countries. These positions are unjust as they are unsustainable. We call on the United States and other developed countries to recognize their historic responsibilities for the causes and adverse consequences of climate change and to repay their climate debts to Africa and other developing countries. Allowing temperatures to rise by up to 2 degrees globally and thus to 3 degrees in Africa is a death sentence to literally millions of Africans. We fear for our mothers and fathers, our sisters and brothers, your uncles and aunts and cousins. Your policy on climate change threatens not only our families, but also your own. We implore you not to crush the dreams of our fathers. Yours sincerely, your brother, your uncles, your aunties and cousins from Africa.
A couple of days ago here in Copenhagen, the Center for Biological Diversity launched their new report at a Greenpeace US side event, which showed how President Obama can come to Copenhagen at the end of next week with a strong domestic target that is consistent with the latest science. The report draws on the work of 3 legal scholars and decisions of the Supreme Court and shows that Obama will have no excuses if he comes to Copenhagen and brokers an inadequate deal.
So I'm here with Cassie Siegel from the Center for Biological Diversity in the US.
Co-author of a new report, Yes He Can.
And the report, it's called Yes He Can, President Obama's Power to Make an International Climate Commitment Without Waiting for Congress.
Okay. First, I thought we'd look at what Obama is currently said he would bring to Copenhagen, just to put everything in context for people and how that matches up and whether it's good enough. But what has he currently said he would do?
What the president has proposed is for the U.S. To put a politically binding deal on the table to cut emissions about 17% below 2005 levels by 2020. That translates into only about 3% below 1990 levels. And this proposal is completely inadequate because it's completely out of line with what the science says we need to do. The science says we need to get carbon dioxide back to below 350 parts per million. That means reductions of 45% or more from the U.S. and other industrialized countries.
And that's without using offsets as well?
Well, that's without using offsets, because offsets generally don't get you real reductions. And we need real reductions of 45% or more below 1990 levels. And, you know, that is to avoid absolute climate chaos. I mean, the climate scientists have their hair on fire about this stuff. I mean, we're already seeing massive impacts. 300,000 people per year already die because of global warming. We're destroying entire ecosystems. Polar bears, a species that I work on, they're drowning, starving, and even resorting to cannibalism just from the rapid climate change we're already seeing. We're approaching or have already passed tipping points. And the 3% below 1990 levels that's on the table will lead to catastrophe. It's not something we can go forward with.
So is Obama coming forward with the 3% because that is what the House of Representatives have currently passed? And if so, I understand that actually that form of legislation, if that were to go right through Congress, you had a graph the other night that showed a Breakthrough Institute analysis that with offsets, actually there might be an increase in carbon emissions under that kind of cap-and-trade style legislation. So what's going on?
Well, that's right. The president's proposal mirrors the reductions that are in the climate bill that passed the House of Representatives this summer. And while the bill says that it aims to reduce emissions 3% below 1990 levels by 2020, actual U.S. emissions could continue to go up all the way through 2026. The reason that is because the bill contains 2 billion tons of offsets. And to give you a sense of scale, the total emissions of the U.S. economy is about 7 billion tons per year. So with 2 billion tons of offsets in the bill, you could have actual emissions continue to go up all the way through 2026. So polluters would continue to pollute. They would just theoretically be paying someone somewhere else to say that they're sequestering carbon or reducing carbon or what have you. But if you have actual emissions go up through 2026, we're talking about climate catastrophe. We can't allow that to happen.
Now, there's been a new development, I understand, this week with Lisa Jackson, head of the Environmental Protection Agency, making an announcement about an intention to go ahead and use the existing authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate things like coal-fired power plants. Is that in order to back up this 3% pledge, or is there something else going on?
Well, it's actually separate, and that's one of the things we address in our report. It's often stated that the president can't commit to a deal here until Congress acts, or that we can't start reducing our emissions in the U.S. and commit to numeric targets until we get a new climate bill. That's actually not true, because we already have a law called the Clean Air Act. It is one of the world's most successful environmental laws, and it already provides a comprehensive system for the reduction of greenhouse pollution. The Bush administration refused to implement the Clean Air Act for greenhouse gases. The Supreme Court said that was illegal. And now the Obama administration is going forward with pollution reductions under the Clean Air Act as a result of that Supreme Court decision. And so it is really a fallacy to say that the president's hands are tied because Congress hasn't acted. The president can commit to science-based, deep and rapid emissions reductions here in Copenhagen, and he can achieve them through the Clean Air Act. He just needs to fully implement the law. What most people don't know, though, is that the climate bills under consideration in Congress would actually gut the Clean Air Act, and they would prevent the EPA from using this existing law, which is much stronger than the new climate bill, from actually solving the problem.
Now, some people have been saying that the Obama administration has been using the threat of EPA authority as a kind of bargaining chip in order to get a kind of cap-and-trade bill through. So it's like saying to industry, if you don't accept this actually industry-friendly legislation, then we'll kind of clobber you with some proper regulation. But does the Lisa Jackson announcement mean that it's no longer a bargaining chip, but they're actually going to go ahead and use it regardless?
Well, we certainly hope so, and we and others have been working on this intensely. Lisa Jackson said something really good the other day. She said this isn't an either-or situation, and that's what we've been saying all year. It is a ridiculous way to frame the issue. to say that you have to have climate legislation or the Clean Air Act. There's absolutely no reason for that. The Clean Air Act is the strongest tool, the best tool for reducing greenhouse pollution. It's also completely compatible with any other tool that Congress might want to put in place. So, for example, when Congress put in a cap-and-trade system for acid rain in 1990, they did that. They didn't take away any of the Clean Air Act's programs. They left that safety net in place for the acid rain pollutants, for sulfur dioxide and oxides of nitrogen. This notion that we're going to trade the Clean Air Act for a new cap-and-trade bill is an absolute travesty. We must not do that. We have to keep the safety net of the Clean Air Act, whatever else Congress chooses to do.
Okay. Realistically, what do you think Obama is going to do at the end of next week? I know you've been petitioning along with 350.org, the Obama administration, or perhaps the Environmental Protection Agency directly, in order to use their existing authority to do something which is consistent with the science. I don't know, are the wheels turning fast enough for that to happen? Or is this meeting going to end in crisis that everyone expects?
Right. Well, it's a long shot at this point for a good outcome here, a very, very long shot. You have to be an optimist to believe that the future is uncertain when you work in climate change, unfortunately. But one of the things we're trying to do with our report is we're trying to get the word out there that these assumptions that the president's hands are tied by Congress or that we can't act until we have a new climate bill are false. And when the administration says that 3% below 1990 is the best they can do because we don't have a climate bill, that's absolutely incorrect. The president has all the legal tools he needs to cut a deal here. When the administration has the political will to get something done, you do not hear them complaining about Congress blocking it. They get it done. And we want everybody to know that it is not a legal constraint on the president if he doesn't put a better deal here on the table. It is a political choice. And I'm not trying to downplay the difficulty of the political situation in the U.S. We have enormous challenges. We have misinformation and confusion about climate science rampant. We have endless debates. But the president ran on a promise of change and a promise to take action on climate change. And it will be an enormous act of moral and political courage to do so. But that's what the science demands, and that's what we're asking him to do. The science says we must. The law says we can, and we need everyone to demand of President Obama that he say, yes, we will.
That was Cassie Siegel of the Center for Biological Diversity, co-author of the report Yes, He Can, President Obama's Power to Make an International Climate Commitment Without Waiting for Congress. Direct regulation is one of the key tools that brings about the 40% reduction in the European Union that a recent report by the Stockholm Environmental Institute scoped out for Friends of the Earth that we heard about earlier in the week on Copenhagen Daily. But do we need to fundamentally change our economy if we are to bring about a truly sustainable society? That's certainly the view of many of the protesters who will be on the streets in force here next week. But it's also the view of an increasing number of progressive thinkers and academics. Now, even the UK government's own advisers are saying that we need a fundamental rethink of our economy. Frederica Whitehead caught up with Professor Tim Jackson at the Parallel People Summit, the Klima Forum, here in Copenhagen.
This is Climate Radio, and I'm speaking to Tim Jackson. Tim Jackson is an economist, an advisor to the UK government, Professor of Sustainable Development at the University of Surrey, member of the UK government's independent watchdog on sustainable development, the Sustainable Development Commission, and an author. And Tim's got a new book out called Prosperity Without Growth. So Tim, can you tell me, in layman's terms, what prosperity without growth means and how it might help us tackle climate change?
Well, the basic idea is to say that prosperity, our ability to do well, to have a good life, is not being delivered by a growth-based economy. The growth-based economy is sort of betraying that idea, really, undermining it in very specific ways. And so the book asks the question, actually, could you do one thing without the other thing? Could you have prosperity? Could you have a good society? Could you have the ability for people to flourish and do well in their lives but without the growth-based economy that's undermining community, that's failing to deliver to the poorest nations and that's driving us towards an ecological cliff.
So how would people's lives change if the proposals in your report or your book of the same title were adopted?
Well, they'd be better in all sorts of ways. At least that's the idea. I mean, the point is actually, you know, to undo some of the damage that a growth-based economy is doing, like systematically driving people out of work, like undermining communities, like tearing up the quality of life in the natural environment. And so you can think of, I mean, it's perfectly possible to think of a society actually where our communities are stronger, we have more engagement with our friends and families, where we can still achieve the things that we need to in material terms, food, clothing, and shelter, but our ability to participate in society is strengthened. There's more emphasis on social space, there's more local activity, there's more sense of being able to engage with each other on an everyday basis in a meaningful way. And there is also a sense that this is a dream, this is a way of life, a way of thinking about the world that isn't going to drive us all to ecological destruction.
So without growth, how will developing countries improve their standard of living?
Prosperity without growth is a message for the advanced nations. It's there's no doubt at all that income growth in the developing, in the poorest nations, is still needed. It's still necessary to improve real human development in the poorest nations. And actually, all the data shows that income growth in the poorest nations has a very good outturn. It improves life expectancy, it improves participation in education, it reduces infant mortality. All of the real indicators of human development are improved by income growth in the poorest nations. So what prosperity without growth is saying is actually what we need to do is make room for growth where it matters most. And instead of the idea that we can all just get richer and richer and richer and eventually the poorer nations will be pulled off the bottom, so to speak, prosperity without growth says that model doesn't work. We need to think about a different model, and one where the advanced nations develop in different ways.
How is prosperity without growth different from convergence and contraction?
Convergence and contraction is a very fundamental idea, and it sits actually at the heart of prosperity without growth in terms of rights and ethical responsibilities. And contraction and convergence says there's a finite amount of ecological space and we should divide it up fairly. That's exactly the idea. And that idea motivates prosperity without growth. It says if that's the case, and it is a morally defensible viewpoint, then you have to refigure your systems. In particular, you have to refigure your economic system, and you have to have an economic system that doesn't drive itself increasingly towards more and more resource throughput, more and more consumption, even in the richest nations. You have to be able to devise an economy that works in a different way if you want to achieve contraction and convergence.
What needs to change in the minds of politicians for them to accept and put in the policies that we would need for prosperity without growth?
I mean, in a way, it's a very small thing. It's just opening our mind to possibilities and also facing the stark facts. And the stark facts are that growth-based economies failed in its own terms, collapse of the last year, and no real indication that we're over the worst of that or that we can continue business as usual. It's failure to deliver on global equity, on fair shares for people, and the fact that it is still driving us towards more and more resource extraction and more environmental impact. So accepting those stark facts and then answering the question honestly, do we have the policies, do we have the political will, do we have the institutions that could lead us to a different place? And once those facts are faced, actually, then that's probably good enough. You know, you open out the political space, you open up the space in your mind, and then you start to look for solutions. But until we do that, until we let go of the idea that it's possible to square the circle by just pushing harder at growth, then it's difficult to see the change that's needed even to achieve an agreement such as the one that's being chased here in Copenhagen.
Can I just ask you your opinions on the global carbon market? Does it tally with your concept?
It's difficult to see the global carbon market as being entirely value-free, because the way that it's been set up and the way that it's been structured in the climate negotiations has largely been as a way to, at least initially, escape the implications that developed nations have to change. So it's a part of the architecture of keeping the system as normal as far as we can, so that our lives, our lifestyles, our institutions, our structures don't need to change. And the reality is, you know, for as long as it's protecting us from that stark fact, then it's probably not being very constructive. And I'm not ruling out the possibility that there should be a price on carbon. I'm not ruling out the possibility that we should share the way we achieve carbon reductions. But I think a global carbon market that attempts to perpetuate the existing system is destructive.
So are you advocating a carbon rationing? You're saying a price on carbon. How would that ability to emit be allocated if it wasn't through cap and trade?
Well, cap is a very good idea, and the idea of a carbon ration is a very good idea. Actually, ultimately, that is how we have to deliver fair shares in carbon. What I'm arguing for really is just care over the trade element of it. If it creates a hypermarket which simply maintains the ability of the advanced nations to carry on pumping carbon into the atmosphere, if it's structured in that way, then it's potentially very damaging. If it can be structured in ways that are fair, that allow fair shares and fair access, then that trade element, I think, probably still has a role to play.
That was Frederica Whitehead with Tim Jackson of the Sustainable Development Commission, an author of Prosperity Without Growth. So what's stopping such an apparently long overdue fundamental rethink of our economy? Could it be the unhealthily close relationship that's built up recently between government and corporations? Here's Frederica Whitehead again.
In Copenhagen Harbour, there famously sits a sculpture of the star of Hans Christian Andersen's story, The Little Mermaid. The mermaid was willing to sacrifice her immortal life in the sea in order to live with the human love of her life. Ironically, the story was published alongside another Christian Andersen classic, The Emperor's New Clothes. And it's possibly The Emperor's New Clothes which is equally relevant to the award that we're about to talk about. It's doubly fitting that a coalition of NGOs and activists have set up the Angry Mermaid Award. The award recognises the role of corporate lobbyists and highlights the efforts of business groups and companies in sabotaging the climate talks and other climate measures and promoting false solutions for their own profit. This is an award for companies who capitalise on public goodwill and direct their products towards people who want to do the right thing. Companies that greenwash or use techniques such as astroturfing to dupe both the public and the politicians. We're very happy to have one of the organisers behind the award here to speak to us on Climate Radio. I'm at the Bella Centre with Paul de Klerk. Paul de Klerk is the head of the Economic Justice Campaign at Friends of the Earth Europe. Hello, Paul.
Yes, hello.
Paul, can you tell me about the nominees for the Angry Mermaid Award?
Yes, we had a process where the people, the general public or civil society organisations could nominate candidates. We received between 30 and 40 candidates, and out of that we selected 8 companies or branch organizations. These are the American Petroleum Institute, the International Air Travel Association, Sasol, a South African oil company, Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, the International Emission Trading Association, Monsanto, CEFIC, the chemical industry in Europe, and the last one is the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. And all of, well, they are in different groupings. Some of these companies or associations are still in the process of denying that climate change is actually a big problem. More of the other ones are basically into promoting what we call false solutions. For instance, an unexpected candidate is, for instance, Monsanto, because normally you wouldn't link Monsanto to climate change, but Monsanto has been over the last years very actively lobbying for some of its new techniques related to promoting GM soy to get climate credits, so that they would get CO2 allowances out of this process for their new GM soy. Also, a lot of companies are involved in promoting new techniques such as coal to liquids or carbon storage, especially companies like Shell, Cefic, and also the Sasol are very strongly involved in that. The American Petroleum Institute is another case. These are the main oil companies in the US, and they have run a very strongly campaign against the climate bill in the U.S., the bill which is under consideration at the moment. They've been lobbying very strongly against that. They've mobilized their own workers, pretending that these were the general public.
So that's the practice of astroturfing, so fake lobbying.
Yes, exactly. Fake lobbying, pretending that this is a broad movement, but actually it was all set up by the oil companies, and it was partly, to a large extent, were their own workers.
So this is fake grassroots activism, mimicking the behaviours of grassroots activism, but by corporate employees.
Yeah. That's what referred to as astroturf. The American Clean Coal Electricity Association Coalition, they went even a step further. They used actually false letters. They sent letters to members of the U.S. government. And these were just letters on behalf of all kinds of organizations, and they turned out to be fake letters. They had to admit that, and there was a lot of publicity on that in the U.S. But they didn't actually withdraw their positions. So they were really just faking kind of pressure from civil society. So these are the type of candidates that we're putting forward. The general public can vote for different candidates via internet, www.angrymermaid.org. You can go to the website and you can vote for one of the 8 candidates. And also we will be walking around here in the coming days until the 13th to promote the lobby awards, and also give people walking around here the opportunity to cast their vote. On the 15th, we'll announce who is the winner. We'll have a ceremony where Naomi Klein will be taking part, and she will be disclosing who is the winner. We'll do that at a press conference here in the Bella Center, and then we will also have a more humorous announcement in the Klima Forum where we will celebrate the winner.
I'm Frederic Whitehead. This is Climate Radio on Resonance FM. That was Paul de Klerk from Friends of the Earth Europe telling us about the nominees for the Angry Mermaid Award. And as we said, you can vote at angrymermaid.org. And the award is for the company that you, the listeners, think has caused the most damage to the climate or the climate talks through backroom shenanigans, astroturfing, fake lobbying.
Yeah, I mean it's not always backroom lobbying. It's also very open. I mean, like organizations like Cefic or Shell at the European level, they are very often very open in their lobbying, but they have an enormous power over European decision makers. For instance, Cefic. I mean, the European Commission last year launched its new emission trading system, and the new thing about it was that companies actually had to pay for their emission rights. Next step they did, after an intense lobbying of some of the most energy intensive associations and corporations, is that they excluded the chemical industry, the oil and gas industry, the cement industry, all the industries which are the highest in their CO2 pollution. They excluded them from having to pay for it. So they made, basically, their lobbying resulted in making the instrument ineffective. So that's the kind of, that didn't happen behind closed doors. They were very open in that. They were even threatening, if we don't get our permits for free, we're just going to take our companies out of Europe. So they were very open in that. It's the kind of blackmailing the European Commission.
Okay, so you can vote for the Angry Mermaid Award, the big business that has lobbied the hardest to block effective action to tackle the problem of climate change or to prevent climate justice. Cast your vote at angrymermaid.org until midnight.
Until the 13th, midnight.
Midnight yeah. On Sunday the 13th. Yeah. Climate Radio will be broadcasting from the awards ceremony on Tuesday the 15th.
Yes.
Where Naomi Klein will be present. Yeah. Yeah. So you can find out who won.
We haven't covered much of it yet, but there is a whole parallel people's conference going on in central Copenhagen. We've been mainly camped out in the Bella Centre, the official conference centre for the UN talks, and there's already too much to keep up with here. Nevertheless, by some kind of miracle, Frederica made a successful escape attempt. Here she is with a representative of the Klima Forum, then gathering testimony from a member of Nigerian civil society.
Hello, I'm speaking to Christine Holton Anderson. She's the spokesperson for the Klima Forum. This is the first Klima Forum. Can you tell me what the Klima Forum is and how it differs from the sort of official, more formal COP15?
Klima Forum 09 is the alternative climate summit. We call it the People's Climate Summit. This Klima Forum is open to everybody. You can just walk in from the street and participate in the workshops, the talks, the seminars, the film exhibitions, and all sorts of things are going on here. So it's a great festival, but it's also a climate summit for people like you and me.
Can you just tell me something of what's going on at Klima Forum today, tomorrow, and until the end of the Copenhagen talks?
At Klima Forum, we have a very varied program. So we have small workshops with Indigenous People Speak Out, that was today, with Indigenous people from the Amazon and also from Northern Europe. And then we have some on the other line, we have some great speakers. Today we had Tim Jackson and Naomi Klein speaking here. Tomorrow we'll have Vandana Shiva, and also we'll have George Monbois next week. So we have great names, and then we have a lot of small things going on.
And I have just met Ayodele
Akele.
From Nigeria.
Yep.
Can you tell me why you've come to Copenhagen?
Well, we are part of delegates of Human Rights Focus Non-Governmental Organization in Nigeria. And we are duly accredited as observer to observe at the COP15, UNFCCC.
What does that mean, an observer?
United Nations. Oh, well, all non-governmental organizations are not parties. We are not negotiators. All non-governmental human rights groups are graded as observers. Okay. Country representatives, government officials are the negotiators. Okay. They are the parties. But all observers of human rights activists and non-governmental organizations are grouped as observers.
So have you come to keep an eye on your delegates and to make sure that they get the deal that you want?
Maybe I should just explain the mechanism. We are observer that we are a pressure group. We are NGO demanding better approach to the climate change issue.
Okay.
And we have no illusion that the way this negotiation has been going over time,
yeah,
we have no hope that there is something concrete. But despite that, we are still pushing the negotiators, we are still pushing the government side, the parties, to satisfy the yearnings and aspirations of the people.
Okay.
But having observed that there is no likelihood of our getting justice, of our securing our demands, we are here to promote an agenda of people's protocol.
So you can see
this orange scarf.
Yes, I've seen lots of people in these orange scarves.
People's movement on climate change. We are projecting, we are canvassing, we are advocating for an alternative protocol. People's protocol, which does not require the ratification of any government. The masses of the whole world, we want to take their fate into our hands. And the draft of protocol has been on for over 2 years, been debated. We have ratified it in Nigeria, Nigerian NGOs. Yesterday, we had an assembly of global representatives of all the human rights groups, all the NGOs here. And it was ratified here yesterday afternoon.
So
we have a people's protocol now. I can give you a copy. And this is what we are here to essentially promote Canva, because it supports, it represents the aspiration, yearnings and of the downtrodden, the masses social movement across the world.
So what you're saying is you have no faith in the UNCCC's treaty, and you have made your own treaty.
Of course, we have ratified our people's protocol. Which is going to be officially submitted to the UNFCCC.
Yep.
And we are having a press conference, I think, on Saturday, where we are also going to showcase it. We are going to present copies for the members of the public, and people should just take our destiny into our hands.
Okay.
Because of the controversy, because of the what has been going on in negotiations over the years, and the role of multilateral corporations, the role of Sierra government, the U.S. government, and many.
Tell me what's in your protocol. What kind of emission cuts are in your people's protocol? And
sovereignty, food sovereignty, power to the people.
Food sovereignty.
Respect for human dignity, and of course, justice on climate issues, adaptation, and reparation, and mitigation.
Okay. Can you tell me what food sovereignty means to you?
I mean, you are aware that these days there are a lot of food waste all over the places, which is the product of GMOs. I mean, it's a serious challenge to, for example, to those of us from Africa. It's a sort of more or less a recolonization of Africa. All these food aids, where our own natural resources, our own natural food, and are being decimated, you know, in preference to the GMO food, which of course naturally is not good for us. They are chemicals.
Yeah.
I mean, you know. So, I mean, on that basis, we are demanding independence for agricultural food sovereignty, whereas we don't want second colonization. You know. So, I'm sure that message is clear.
The EU heads of state are meeting yesterday and today, and climate change and climate finance are on the agenda. This really is the EU's last opportunity to put something on the table that is consistent with the latest science and is also just for the world's majority poor world. As we entered the conference centre yesterday, Friends of the Earth had a message for delegates of the European Union.
Message for climate radio.
Yeah, we are from Friends of the Earth, and Friends of the Earth International demands 40% domestic cuts within Europe, and we need this within Europe. So that means domestic cuts. We reject offsetting. That means what I said. We need the cuts, the emission reduction cuts at home, at least 40% for Europe. And now Friends of the Earth Europe just produced a study with the Swedish Environmental Institute, and we can now show or prove that it is possible to reduce our emissions by at least 40%. That means it's a big challenge. We need big emission cuts via energy efficiency projects, so we have to invest a lot in energy efficiency, in renewables, but also lifestyle change. But this combination, then we can demand climate justice, and we can reach the climate justice.
We were cheered at the end of the long day yesterday when a new song appeared in the inbox from the Carbon Tan Crier. I'm pretty confident that this is the first time that this has been broadcast, but the Carbon Tan Crier will be bringing the song directly to the streets of Copenhagen next week.
We are green, we are red, we are black. We have come to take the power back. We are black, we are green, we are red. We remember what cancer we were said. Lord, take my soul, the struggle continues. Even if we're nursing the no-deal blues. Sub-Zero carnivals have always been my thing. My cozy pink and silver dancing boots I'll be sure to bring. On a pyre of profit, my future they want to fling. But into being such sweet songs, our street souls will sing. Street souls will sing. We are red, we are green. But can we crystallize that which we dream? We dream of oceans unrisen and our friends out of prison and a hurricane of climate justice blowing and of human kindness overflowing. I think it's gonna rain today. Sub-Zero carnivals have always been my thing. My cozy pink and silver dancing boots I'll be sure to bring. With possibility our movements crackle and sing. We have brought the righteous rhythms to make those movements swing. Make the movements swing. Come back with some seeds and some good ideas and some stories and some myths to tell. Yeah, watch me out. We're gonna bring him back, you know, bring him back and put him back. Come on back and put him back and build him up, build him up. Bring it back, yeah, bring him back and build him up, yeah, build it up. Bring it back, yeah, and bring it back and build it up. Bring it back and build it up.
On Wednesday, there was another impromptu demonstration by African civil society here at the Bella Centre. Here's a recording I made of that, followed by a snatch of Farafina's Pacouse from the album Canu on L'Empreinte Digitale from 2001. We make no excuses for our focus on Africa here at Copenhagen Daily. When The Guardian did a feature profiling the countries to watch, Ethiopia, as their token African example, was given an influence rating of 1 out of 5. And yet Africa perhaps has the biggest immediate stake in these negotiations, with the impacts on the continent already devastating. Do join us again tomorrow. Until then, thanks for listening.
Children will not suffer. Stop defending our land.
And you said 2 degrees is too
much.
Yes.
Too much.
Yes.
Too much.
Africa.
These are the drums of Africa. We are telling you, as the people of Africa,
oh, yes.
we shall not be taken for granted.
Oh, yes.
No, we are here because we have come, because our people have told us they do not want to die anymore.
No.
It is too much. 2 degrees is too much for us.
What?
to Copenhagen Daily every day from 11 a.m. till noon throughout the UN Climate Conference on Resonance 104.4 FM and online at resonancefm.com.